spiritual longing, gratitude, and trust. The summer before last, I spent 3 months working as a chaplain in a hospital and its associated hospice care center. Largely because of that, and also because of some circumstances in my personal life, I had an opportunity to talk with a lot of people who were working with very serious illness in their life. And as you can imagine, a lot of these conversations were very real, and they impacted me quite a lot. One of the conversations I had was with a woman who, she actually became a friend. And she is about my age, mid to late 40s. And when I met her, she was just finishing about 8 months of treatment for breast cancer. And she was just beginning the last part of the treatment, which would be another several months. And it was her first diagnosis, and it was her first experience with treatment. In our first meeting, she told me about her life. And she described herself as living pretty much with her head down. That's what she said, that she'd been pretty much living with her head down. So she told me that she had gone to high school and finished high school and gone to college. In college, she'd fallen in love, and she graduated from college and gotten married. Got a job. Her husband got a job. She got another job and a promotion, and they bought a house. He also did, and they bought a house. Years went by, and eventually they got divorced. She said then she found a different place to live, went back to school, got another job. Eventually, she bought another house. And she said she'd just been going from one thing to the next, just doing what needed to be done. And she told me that now, because of cancer, everything had changed. Now, for her, she said she really wanted to know about meaning. She said she wanted to know what is the meaning of life and what gives life meaning. And she said that she didn't know what those questions would mean for her life. She wasn't sure if it meant that she'd have to find a different job that might give meaning, or what. She said she really had no idea. All she knew was that she really wanted to know about meaning. And then she said to me that she was afraid. And when she said that, I thought that she might mean that she wouldn't find meaning. Or that perhaps she was so overwhelmed, given what was happening in her life, that and she didn't know where to look or how to begin searching. But that wasn't what she said or meant. I asked her, "Do you know what you're afraid of?" And she said, "I'm afraid I'll forget." It was very, very powerful. She went on to say that she was afraid that the cancer would be taken care of, and that her body would heal from the treatment, and that she'd go back to living the way she had been before, with her head down, and that she'd forget these questions. In Pali, there is a word, samvega, and it's usually translated as spiritual urgency. It is an experience that the Buddha himself had. Many of us here, I'm sure, have heard of samvega, have heard this word before. And a lot of us, I think, have been introduced to this word in the context of hearing the story of the Buddha's early life. So the Buddha was born Siddhartha in an area of an area that's now, I think, central Nepal. It's Lumbini, and I think that's central Nepal. I haven't been there. He was the son of a tribal leader in that area, a clan chief of the Sakyan clan. So he was born into a well-known and a wealthy family. Legend has it that his father wanted to protect him or prevent him from seeing the harsh realities of life. So as a boy, he grew up very sheltered. It's said that he lived in one of three of the family palaces. There was one for the hot season, one for the dry season, one for the rainy season. And that he was completely surrounded all the time by what I consider or think of as wine, women, and song. But I'm not sure that's the way. It's not said that way in the suttas. But the palaces were just filled with beauty of every form. Lotus ponds, flowers of different colors, lotuses of different colors, incense, people surrounding him that were friendly, young, healthy, vibrant, musicians ready to play at any time, beautiful, lovely music for his ears. So surrounded by beauty for all the senses. When Siddhartha was in his late 20s, he had a growing curiosity of what was outside his life as he knew it, what was outside the palace walls. And so he convinced his driver, Chanda, to help him sneak outside the palace. And he did that on three successive occasions. And the first visit, in each of the three visits, he came face to face with what are called the divine messengers or heavenly messengers. And these are said to be celestial beings that are disguised in particular human forms. So on the first visit, he came face to face with a very, very old person. And the second visit, he came face to... Actually, the first one was a very, very sick person. Sorry. Yeah. I was thinking old. Yeah. First visit, very, very sick person. The second visit, he saw a very, very old person. And on the third visit, he saw a funeral procession that was bringing a corpse to the funeral pyre. And in each of these visits, he realized that each of these things would happen to him. And it's said that it had a great impact on him and that a profound sense of samvega arose in him as a result of these three visits. So that's a story that many of us have heard. And I think it's important to take some time with it. I want to read to you the Buddha's description of that experience of samvega. These are his words as recorded in the Anguttara Nikaya, which is one of the collections of the Buddha's discourses. And it's a little long, but I think it's worthwhile. So he said, "Even though I was endowed with such fortune, such total refinement, the thought occurred to me, when an untaught run-of-the-mill person..." I love that part. "When an untaught run-of-the-mill person, himself subject to aging, not beyond aging, sees another who is aged, he is troubled, ashamed, or otherwise put off, forgetful that he himself is such a one. But if I, who am subject to aging, not beyond aging, were to be troubled, ashamed, or otherwise put off, on seeing another person who is aged, that would not be fitting for me. And as I noticed this, the typical young person's intoxication with youth entirely dropped away." And he goes on, "And if I, who am subject to illness, not beyond illness, were to be troubled, ashamed, or otherwise put off on seeing another person who is ill, that would not be fitting for me. And as I notice this, the typical healthy person's intoxication with health entirely dropped away. And if I, who am subject to death, not beyond death, were to be troubled, ashamed, or otherwise put off upon seeing another person who is dead, that would not be fitting for me. And as I noticed this, the typical living person's intoxication with life entirely dropped away. So that's very powerful. As I said, Samvega most often is translated as spiritual urgency. But there really is no one word in the English language that fully captures it, because Samvega includes a very broad array of emotion. I think when we hear urgency, we tend to focus on or get a sense that there's some kind of hurry, that life is short and there's preciousness to our time and to how we spend it. And I think this is an aspect of Samvega. It's said that human birth is very rare, and our life, our time in this lifetime is limited, and how we spend it is very important. And Samvega is a much broader experience. The word intoxication is very important, I think, here. He said, the typical person's intoxication with youth, health, and life entirely dropped away. One definition of intoxication is an altered state as if by a poisoning. And that's pretty intense. But it's important, because I think that we so often think of the spiritual journey or the spiritual process or path as leading to an altered state. But the Buddha here is saying that, no, it's actually our typical way of living. That's the altered state. It's a typical way of living is the altered state. It's like what my friend described as living with her head down. So Samvega is a shake-up, for sure. It shakes us up out of a kind of complacency. Bhikkhu Bodhi, some of you may know his work. He's a monastic in the Thai forest tradition. A scholar who's done a lot of translation. He describes or defines Samvega as, this is a quote from him, recognizing the radical deficiency that runs through our worldly concerns. And Tanisaro Bhikkhu describes it as recognizing the meaninglessness of life as normally lived. So when I say that, I want to just sort of jump out there and say, okay, now before everybody goes off the deep end with this, because it sounds really intense, the meaninglessness of life as it's normally lived. But the thing is, it doesn't mean that life is meaningless. And it doesn't mean that our way of living is meaningless as lay people or living, you know, having jobs and having families. That's not what it means. It means the intoxication is meaningless. That's the important thing. So the sense of urgency in spiritual urgency is that there's a shift in our lives. That spiritual questions that are beyond those of our daily just getting along questions, deeper questions, those come more to the fore. And I think often this experience happens under our radar. You know, we might not even be aware of it except for in hindsight. But a shift definitely has happened within us. And often, I think also Samvega comes with a sense of feeling discontent or some feeling of disenchantment with the way that we've been living. So it's not a comfortable feeling. And it can be really unsettling. But as my friend knew very viscerally, very instinctually, Samvega is a gift. It is a tremendous gift, this experience. And part of the reason it's a gift is because just on the heels of Samvega arises a feeling within called, that I call, spiritual longing. It's a profound longing for something deeper. There's a poem by Hafez that I really like, and I leaned on it quite a lot in my early years of practice. And I think it's really funny, but nobody else does, so you don't have to laugh. But it's called So Damn Thirsty. And here it is. First, the fish needs to say, there's something ain't right about this camel ride, and I'm feeling so damn thirsty. And I love that poem. I love the image of a fish on a camel in the desert going along, right? And he's just going along, and then there's this little inkling like, what is going on? There's something that's not quite right here, you know? There's just this sort of instinctual thing like, what? You know? And of course the fish is thirsty. And of course we're thirsty. You know, that's why we're here. That's why we do this practice. It's that instinctual longing for our natural home. So I want to say that this thirst, this longing, is very different than the hunger that Heather spoke about last night. So that hunger was this constant, incessant movement of the heart that's motivated by greed, hatred, and delusion. So the thirst that I'm talking about here, that thirst of that fish, spiritual longing, is that deep ache for knowing our natural home, our true home. You can understand why my friend was so afraid that she'd forget. Having sat a fair bit in our lives, everyone here has sat a bit. I think we can all relate to that feeling. It's like when you touch into something that's so deep, you know, something that speaks from the essence, it feels like the essence of being. When you touch into something like that, it's normal to be afraid that we'll lose track of it. I often think it's like touching into something like that is like finding a treasure, a precious treasure. And then, of course, naturally we have this feeling, and you know it, when you've touched into something so deep and you get that feeling that, you know, you don't want to hang on to it too tightly because you have that instinctual feeling that you'll squish it. Somehow hanging on, it won't work if you hold too tight. But then there's that feeling like, well, I don't want to not hold because it'll slip through my fingers. You know, so there's just that they touch into those feelings. And there's that sense, and we get afraid. It's really important to know that when these shifts happen, they can't be lost. Any kind of deep touching in like that, it resides in the continuum of our understanding. So even though there are times that it might not be in our consciousness, or it may go dormant for a while, it's like there's been a profound change, an alteration in our fundamental understanding. And it doesn't reverse. Those shifts of fundamental understanding don't reverse. Spiritual longing can show up in a number of different ways. It's the second day of retreat, the second full day of retreat, and so there's some quiet happening. we got to meet with you today, some of you, and so of course things are settling down, there's quiet, mindfulness is developing. And when that happens, as you all know, we start becoming more attuned to what's happening in our hearts and minds. And so I know from my own experience that right around now it feels like the hindrances start marching in. You know, it's like you start becoming a little bit more attuned, and there they are in all their glory. So sleepiness, restlessness, that sense of dislike of parts of ourselves that we can see so clearly now, and wanting this and that, wanting our practice to yield something, or wanting a particular experience, or doubts. Why are we here? Why are we doing this again? Those little thoughts that arise. And I think often, sometimes there's a response like, it might feel like, well, that's not what I came here for, actually. but it's a beautiful thing about retreat, because that actually, you all know this, that actually is part of the process. That's part of the journey. Coming to know these things and developing a relationship of wisdom and love with them, that is part of the work that we do. So it's a beautiful thing about retreat, having the time for that to those things to show. And another beautiful aspect about having the space and quiet that retreat gives us is that I think we can get in touch, we can really come to know and feel this sense of longing, of spiritual longing. You can feel it. You can feel it if you let it in. It's really important. So it's like you might walk down or out in the field and just feel that stillness, start to connect with the stillness, feel the earth, hear the birds, see the sky. And then maybe there's just a little sense of sadness. And then maybe a familiar question comes like, what is that? Why is that? Or spiritual longing could express as a heart that falls in love very easily, like wants to connect with or sort of tunes into the beautiful qualities in others and wants to connect with them. Or perhaps you have experienced a sense of inner calling, but then there's this not really sure what you're being called to or toward. So these are some of the ways that spiritual longing can express. No matter how it expresses, you'll hear in those, it tends to have this aching quality. And as we come to know it and look underneath, we can see that it really comes out of two movements of the heart. One is the longing for true connection, and the other is a longing for understanding. And these two things are really just one thing, which is a longing for the truth, a longing to know the truth. A longing for freedom. Here's another Hafez poem. It's called Constant Yearning. And of course, Hafez is a Persian mystic, not a Buddhist, but it doesn't matter, because spiritual longing, longing for truth, doesn't have anything to do with anything like that. So here's Hafez. I think he speaks to this so beautifully here. We are like lutes once held by God. Being away from his warm body fully explains this constant yearning. So again, a different tradition, but that sense of longing to know the truth, that longing, that separation, of course there's longing. It's valuable to tune into this longing, to let yourself feel it and to come to know it. Because in daily life, in the outward world, being out in the world, it's so easy to misinterpret this feeling, this emotion, especially in Western culture. And I say that I don't have very much experience with Asia, so I can't really say if it's just Western culture. But from my very limited experience, it seems like in our particular culture, we have very little context for the emotions of samvega and spiritual longing. So when we experience this, I think it can be very painful and disheartening. Often when we experience this in our lives, if we're not familiar with it, then I think we turn outward. We can turn outward to our surrounding culture for a sense of resonance, or to to be understood in that feeling, or to be held in that experience, or to have some sort of framework reflected back that can help us hold that in ourselves. But because I think our culture doesn't have a lot of context for that emotion, sometimes the feedback that we get is that we should be happy for what we have. Just be grateful for what you have. Or maybe you need to focus on the positive things in life. Or maybe you're just a little bit too sensitive and you shouldn't question so much. And when we get that sort of feedback from an outer culture, we can begin to question and doubt the essential goodness of this movement of the heart, this deep sense of longing. And what can happen, I think, or what we often do, is that we transfer that emotion into an assessment of the outer conditions of our lives, or outer aspects of our life. So sometimes we have that feeling, we have that ache, and we think, okay, something's wrong, or something's missing. And so then we do something. So we change jobs, or we get in a relationship, or we get out of a relationship, or we change relationships, or we move, we change houses, or we change cities. And it's not to say sometimes that these are really important things to do, that there aren't really good, healthy reasons to change job, change relationships, get in a relationship, get out of a relationship. I'm not at all saying that. This is why it gets so complicated, to discern those different things. So there are good reasons to make changes in outer aspects of our lives. But with spiritual longing is something altogether different. So getting the optimal combination of conditions in our outer lives doesn't address it at all. So as we go through these changes in our lives, which we could be doing for other reasons, or we could be doing responding to something's wrong, if it's spiritual longing, it'll be back. It'll appear again. There'll be that feeling of ache. And I think that sometimes we can get really weary in that process, again and again trying to put the right things together that leads to happiness. And eventually, sometimes in that process, through that wearying process, I think we can shift our assessment from something's wrong with the outer conditions to something's wrong with me. And you can see how that can lead to confusion and despair and depression. So this is why I say it's so important to know, to come to know and to understand and also appreciate samvega and spiritual longing for what it is, for what they are, and for what they do. There are two other parts of the Buddha's early life, the story of the Buddha's early life, that support us, I think, in working with this emotion, or not working with it, but just connecting with it, allowing, relating to it. And that lifts our hearts and help us appreciate this persistent ache in our hearts, which I know you all know. You wouldn't be here if you didn't know this experience. So one of the parts of the Buddha's early life that can help lift our hearts here is that when Siddhartha was just a few weeks old, a seer, a wise sage, was called to the palace to predict the baby's future. So the seer came and saw the baby and took him in. And then he predicted that Siddhartha would either be a great clan chief like his father, or he would be a very important and influential spiritual leader. And it's because of this prediction that it's said that his father kept him so secluded and protected from all the harsh realities of life, not wanting him to have anything that might influence a spiritual movement for him, spiritual movement in his heart. But the thing I like about this story is that it begs the question, what did the seer see in this little baby? What did he perceive? So I know most of you have heard of the paramis. These are spiritual qualities that are said to be perfected in a Buddha. The perfection, another way to say that, is the perfection of these qualities issues in Buddhahood. So these are qualities that we all have to some extent, to varying degrees, that have been developed to varying degrees and said over lifetimes, that they're developed over lifetimes. So in the Theravada tradition, there are 10 of these. So there are things like generosity, patience, loving kindness, determination or resolve, truthfulness, renunciation, and there are others. And among these 10 paramis is wisdom. Sometimes wisdom is called inner knowing or intuitive knowing, and it's key, very valuable. We talk about wisdom and compassion, developing love and wisdom. So wisdom is a parami, a quality that's perfected over lifetimes. And it's valuable and key because it's the seed of longing. So this quality, it may well be that this parami is what the seer saw, that this quality was so well developed in Siddhartha, even though he was only a few weeks old, that the seer could feel it. It was palpable. And that the seer knew that, given the right conditions, if this seed of longing was watered, that it would sprout and grow into not only spiritual longing, but also profound understanding in that very lifetime for Siddhartha. So I find this very reassuring, because it means that when we feel that ache, we can know where it's born, where it's from, where it's coming from. It's like spiritual longing moves us, and we can trust it. Spiritual longing is also not a one-shot deal. It's a very crucial part of the entire path. So it spurs us on. It's that ache, that movement that spurs us on. And it can spur us on when faith hasn't yet developed or when faith is still in an early tender stage. It pushes us to keep going. And I think in some ways, the longer we practice, the more we rely on it. It's like when you touch into deep insight, then it seems like it's always the case that then you hit a deeper layer of entanglement. It's this practice that seems a cycle of purity, purification. Deep understanding opens the doorway for seeing more clearly. Seeing more clearly, there's more stuff to see. And it goes like this. It goes like this. And so we can hear that this is the process, and we can have teachers and people say to us that this is progress, right? But, and it is progress, but we might know that deep down, but sometimes it's like, ah. But that longing, it's still there, and it's rooted in knowing, and it keeps propelling us forward. It keeps us going. Mm-hmm. there's a quote in this book. This is I Am That by Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, who is a Indian shopkeeper. He's no longer alive, but was considered fully realized. And this is a book of questions and answers to him. Answers from him. Questions to him, answers from him. And so this is a little segment of that. So a questioner asks him, where is the need of giving expression to one's longing? And Maharaj says, no need. Doing nothing is as good. Mere longing, undiluted by thought and action, pure concentrated longing will take you speedily to your goal. It is the true motive that matters, not the manner. And then the questioner says, this is great, unbelievable. How can dull repetition in boredom verging on despair be effective? And Maharaj says, and this is a quote that I have leaned on very much in years of my practice, the very facts of repetition, of struggling on, and of endurance and perseverance in spite of boredom and despair and complete lack of conviction are really crucial. They are not important by themselves, but the sincerity behind them is all important. There must be a push from within and a pull from without. So that last sentence to me, you know, or the last two sentences, they are not important by themselves, but the sincerity behind them is all important. And then this one, there must be a push from within and a pull from without. To me, that speaks to the value of that longing, of that parmi, that longing. And then it's like the outer, it's like we're not doing this alone. There's the inner conditions, and then there's the outer conditions. And they come together. And they come together, and spiritual longing emerges as a result. And it's crucial, and it's rare. There's another piece of the Buddha's story. As I said, there are two parts, I think, that lift our hearts as we come in contact with this achy feeling. And the second part of the second piece of his early life story is that he didn't just go out of the palace three times, right? He went out four times. And the fourth time he went out, he saw a wandering ascetic. This was a person wearing the yellow robes of a spiritual seeker. And in seeing that person, he knew there was a path. He knew there was a way to begin to seek deeper meaning. So having felt that shake-up of Samvega and the ache of the longing on its heels, it's said that the feeling that arose in him when he saw this aesthetic was pasara. It's a Pali word. And it means a combination of clarity, serenity, and confidence. So it's that sense of quiet relief that comes from a sense of resonance. Not this winter, but the winter before, I was in Burma again. And I was up in the Sagayan Hills area. I think a few of you may have been there, that area of Burma. And I was there helping out, managing a retreat, and then I sat self-retreat at a tiny monastery in the hills there for several weeks after. And before I went into self-retreat, I did some wandering around the hills, and they're just filled with monks and nuns and lay people. It's considered the spiritual heart of Burma, and it's just studded with monasteries and pagodas. It's quite a remarkable place. And there was one little pagoda that I'd heard about from one of my teachers. She has had a long-term relationship of just having regular contact with a monk. His name is Myatong Sayadaw, and he is quite far along the path. I don't know what, where or what, but I had a chance to meet him the year before last, and he's just this amazing. He's 98 now, and his body's just skinny, like there's not much left of his body, but he has this round head, and it's just one big smile all the time, and he's just laughing all the time. No matter what you say to him, he can barely hear, and the translator yells in his ear, and then he goes, ha, 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 and then he'll say an answer back, and then he laughs and laughs. I mean, it's just really quite amazing. He's very happy. And when he was young, he had this little pagoda built on the top of a hill there. And I had heard stories about this and about him for several years. And so I wanted to go to this little pagoda. So once I had free time and I was sort of between these two different things I was doing there, I walked up to that pagoda. I went there several times, actually. And the thing about it is it's up on a ridge. And so you have to walk quite a ways to get to it. And so you're walking through, forest, but it's not like forest here. It's like scrubby trees is the way I think of it. It's little scrubby trees that don't give any shade. And it's really hot. I mentioned that yesterday. So it's hot. You have to walk up this big hill. There are trees. And I seem to always have flip-flops that are, plasticky. Anyway, it's not comfortable. I'm sliding around my feet. You're walking up. It's dusty. Sun's beating down. Every time I went there, I could feel myself just being irritable. Every time I approached it, irritation, like hot, not happy, but I'm going to this pagoda. And then you walk and you go in it. And it's like every single time I went in it, there was this cool breeze. It was remarkable. And I don't even know how to describe it. But it's said that Myatong Sayadaw, when he was young, he spent many years practicing there. And it's very small, and there's just one little alcove with a little Buddha, Rupa, and you can sit, you walk up the stairs and you can sit in the little space where the Buddha is. And it's said that he spent many years there practicing, just looking at that Buddha and then embodying, reflecting on the qualities of the Buddha for years. That was his practice when he was young, and he did that there. And so every time I walked in there, I would just sit for a bit, and it was just this feeling of cool breeze. And I think of that as pasara. It's that sense. It's like it soothes the burning, it soothes the ache. And places like this and beings like that, they hold that for us in the world. They help soothe, they help reassure, and let us know there is a path, there is a way, and people have walked it. We can walk it. And there's just an easing in that. And it was so wild there, too, because every time I felt that, I walked outside the pagoda, because cool breeze, you can feel it. I walked outside, no breeze. Hot. Walking, I didn't know where it was coming from, but it was real. It was really quite an amazing experience. I want to share another Burma story with you. Because it had a profound effect on me, and because I think it really supports us. It can shift our view around this this feeling, understanding this feeling. Yesterday I described the first time I went to Burma and the challenges I had in that first week. And I was there practicing for several months, mostly alone, and in the monastery, but in the hall alone. And after about 4.5 months, I was hitting very, very difficult places again in practice, a tremendous amount of fear, and a tremendous amount of doubt was arising on the heels of that. And I had taken robes, so I was a Buddhist nun at that point, and I was really having a hard time. And the Sayadaw there doesn't speak English, and the translator was just learning English. So I got the sense that the abbot would be able to help. He's quite a meditation master, that he'd be able to help me if we could communicate. But, we couldn't very well. And so I was hitting all these difficult places, but I didn't have any support. And so I had heard that Michelle McDonald would be coming, I think some of you know her, would be coming to Chazawa in the north, and she has been one of my teachers. And so I just wanted to check in with somebody who spoke English, you know, and just like get a little input. And so I traveled north. And when I got to Chazawa, the monastery there, I got there a few days before everyone else. And I offered money for a meal for all the monks at the monastery, which is very traditional there when you go to a monastery, that you would offer dana for a meal. And I offered not much money, but enough that they could have a meal of meat, have some protein. There are so many monks and nuns in that area of Burma that it said they don't eat well because there just aren't that many lay people to support them. So I offered enough, was not very much money, but so that they could have a solid meal with protein. And after the meal, an elderly monk came out to speak with me. I was just standing outside the cafeteria. And he came out, and he was about 80-something, he told me, but I can't remember exactly. But he spoke perfect English. So he came out, and so I was in robes, and he approached me, and he said, so, you're an American? And I said, yeah, mm-hmm, I'm an American. Well, at first he thanked me for the meal, of course, and congratulated me for my offering. But then he said this, you're an American? I said, yeah. And he said, so what's your job? And I can't tell you the way that hit me. It was so hard. I was really having a lot of fear and a lot of doubt. I had taken robes with a very open heart, not thinking it would be temporary, not knowing that it would be permanent, but with an open heart, thinking this would be a path for me. And I'm standing there, bald, with pink robes. I don't know if you know, but the Mahasi nuns in Burma wear pink robes, pink and orange. So I'm there with the get-up. I've been doing it for a while. And he says, what's your job? And it blasted me. It was so painful. You know, all those years, I mean, for me, all those years of not being willing to commit to a profession, not really being able to explain that there was something calling, not really knowing what, but, you know, people going, well, what do you do? Well, kind of putting together something that sounds like a reasonable thing that people can relate to. You know, all that came up, and the first question so often in the States when people meet you, what do you do for work? And here I am, having taken this step, at this tiny, you know, hundreds and hundreds of year old monastery, and the guy says to me, what's your job? My heart dropped. It was really hard, and I just sort of summoned up all the presence I could muster, and I said to him, I'm not working right now. And he goes, oh, well, what was your job? And I just couldn't believe it. It didn't stop him at all. And so I reached way back in my history and pulled out a respectable profession, and I gave him that. I said, well, I used to do this. And he said, oh. And that seemed to satisfy him, and I thought, great, okay, we're past that. And then he goes, so you married? And I'm like, no, not married. And then he goes, oh, but you've been married, right? You've been married and you have children. And oh, again, it was like, oh, you know, these ways that I feel like I've been so measured in this culture. And so I said to him, no, I haven't been married, don't have children. And then he got this look like he was really concerned. And he looked at me and he goes, oh, well, but you have family, you have siblings and parents, are they healthy, are they well? And I was like, yes, I can answer one, right? And I go, yeah, I do have siblings and I have parents, and at the moment they're both healthy and well. And so then he stopped and he just gave me this really long look. And he said, so let me understand, you're an American, you have no job. Oh, I'm gonna get teary. You have no job. You're not married, and you don't have children. And your parents are both healthy and well and not needing your care. And you found yourself here. "Oh," he said, "you have such good karma. If you're looking for the truth, you've come to the right place." And I hope that you don't hear that story and think it means that you have to be an American. Or that you have to, yeah. Or that you have to be unemployed. Or that you can't be married or have children. And that you have to have at least one living parent. Because, of course, that's not the point. It's like if that monk were here right now, he'd be standing here in the doorway and he could look at any single one of us and say, "Let me understand. You're a Canadian. You have a very stressful job and children that still need your attention and an elderly parent who needs your care. And yet you found yourself here on this island off the coast of North America 2,500 years after the Buddha's Parinirvana, hearing these teachings in your own language. Oh," he would say, "you have such good karma. If you're looking for the truth, you've come to the right place." That story brings me very easily to gratitude. We can have gratitude for lineage, for the monks and nuns who have preserved these teachings, for the lay people who have preserved them and practiced well so that it could be handed down. We can have gratitude for the other outer conditions in our lives that have led us to this very moment. Our ancestral lineage, our teachers, our friends. It's said that gratitude is the deepest spiritual emotion. And in my experience, gratitude deepens as we move along the path. We develop an understanding and we have insights. We get glimpses of the truth. And when we get glimpses of the truth, whether we recognize them or not, they often are followed by an immediate sense of gratefulness. And sometimes that's joined by tears. Sometimes there's a sense of teariness. It's like they naturally flow from a very deep resonance, from a sense of relief of knowing we've touched something so profound. And as we get glimpses, we can have a direct knowing that there's something bigger going on. Something much bigger, and that this evolution is beyond our small sense of self, much faster unfolding happening than anything that we can grapple. And in this, I think that we discover that there's nothing lost, that nothing is wasted. If we're really attentive, we'll learn that nothing is wasted. So, for example, Heather was laying out the sort of progress of the path last night. And so, for example, there are stages where we hit very deep disenchantment. And it can be very subtle. It's like a disenchantment with all phenomena. And there's a tremendous sense of weariness there. And again, a deep longing, a deep, deep longing for happiness and for freedom. And we'll find there that our experience of life serves us. That all those times that we went through recreating outer conditions to try to add up to happiness, all those times we hit that ache again, hit that ache again, hit that ache again, that will serve us in those moments because we'll learn, we'll know that there is no other place to go. And it will give us the wisdom to stay. And that's very important there. The wisdom to stay and to keep going. And from that, a much, much deeper knowing comes. And that is a knowing of how to find home. So as we grow in this sense of a vaster unfolding, we become more willing to surrender. A surrender to the process of our lives, surrender to this practice, surrender to each moment. I really appreciate some of the teachings of Ajahn Chah, and he says that walking the spiritual path is like planting a chili bush. And I love this analogy. He says our job is to dig the hole, to put the plant in, to water it, fertilize it, and keep the ants away. And then if the chili bush grows and produces fruit, it's none of our business. So if we practice and we attain enlightenment this lifetime, it's none of our business. And if we attain enlightenment next lifetime, it's none of our business. It doesn't matter. We just do the practice. So we come to practice and we come to our lives with no gaining idea. So we don't come to get or to not get. And that's surrender. Surrendering, but with full participation. One of my teachers has described meditation as doing nothing with full commitment. And that's really that sense of that balance, surrendering, but being fully there. Suzuki Roshi says this in another way. I know some of you, Trudy, some of you are familiar with Zen practice. I'm not very familiar with Zen practice, but I love this way Suzuki Roshi expresses the same thing. Zen practice, I understand, emphasizes mudras, somewhat hand mudras. And, particular emphasis on posture, and I think a mudra is part of that, right? I'm looking at Trudy. Yeah, so this is what I'm trying to get at, is this saying by Suzuki Roshi, which is lovely. With our full being, we form the mudra with our hands. I think that's so beautiful. So I think as we do this, we more and more trust that we are just simply streams, all moving consistently toward the sea. So I want to close with a poem by Zen hermit poet Royakon. It's called Caged Birds. And I especially like it because I think it can be read a couple different ways. And the different ways emphasize the naturalness, but also the essentialness of spiritual longing. All along the way. Caged Birds. Time and again, you too must long for your old nest deep in the mountains. Time and again, you too must long for your old nest deep in the mountains. Let's just sit together for a minute.